Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 242nd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Matthew Janakov. I'm Matt Enloe.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have on director Natasha Kermani. She is a feature filmmaker, commercial director, branded content director. She's done it all. She's also a violinist and a composer, though we do not really talk about that at all. But she made a micro-budget feature, and off of that she got another feature. Both of them are in the genre category, sci-fi horror and a horror film, and her second film premiered at the COVID South by Southwest 2020. And now she's in LA, and we dig deep into how she got her movies made, why she moved to LA after she made these movies, and kind of the life of the indie filmmaker slash commercial director, and kind of how, you know, she's been building up her career since film school to today and to LA. And it's, I kind of love digging into the why'd you move to LA story. Hers is relatively fresh. She came from New York, which is also, I think, a place that we would consider like an industry place. So it's a more of a nuanced move, I think, to move to LA from New York, because you would probably typically do it a little later in your career than you would from a different market.
What I was really struck by with talking to Natasha, she's so smart, so thoughtful. But what was especially interesting is that she really runs a parallel career to you and I, you know, like has a very similar trajectory just in terms of like making independent projects and balancing that with branded content and then moving that into a commercial career and then sort of leveling up from there. But what's refreshing and exciting about it is that it is similar to us, but in a totally different world. You know, she's in that horror genre space, sci-fi as well. And, you know, it's just fascinating to see a totally different ecosystem, but to see the same sort of style of success, but also the same sort of tactics being used in order to achieve your goals. And so it was nice because it felt like, oh, you know, you don't have to, our advice doesn't apply merely to comedy directors, right? Like, I think that sometimes I get worried that we're too narrow, even though this is a show, a very specific show, you know? And so it was fascinating to just kind of look into the mirror, as it were, and see a slightly different vantage point.
Yeah. Ironically, it seems like the horror genre and community is like so cozy and friendly and like a family. And it's part of, I think, what enabled Natasha to make this really smooth move across the country and still feel like she has a network of people. And that's cool. It's something that we don't see as much in other genres or in other kind of segments of filmmaking.
Yeah. I mean, I think that anytime you're in a world that's got a subgenre or some sort of, when things are specific enough that there are places for people to congregate and mutual interests, I think that you find that filmmakers are really excited to relate to one another and to support one another. And so all it takes is just a good excuse to coalesce in some way. And maybe that's being a YouTuber, maybe that's being an indie filmmaker, maybe that's being a horror director, maybe that's loving stand-up comedy, but I think like we are all craving that opportunity because it's a thing that we cherish so much and is so much a part of our lifestyle. But you know, it's the reason that we started the podcast is because you don't get to talk to other filmmakers as much as we'd like. So
yeah. Well, speaking of talking to other filmmakers, I'm dying to know what the heck have you been working on lately?
Yeah. Well, I've been writing away and did a table read for a new feature that I'm working on. And it occurred to me that we haven't really talked enough about table reads as a practice and as a motivational tool and as a part of your craft and a part of your process, basically. So I thought we could talk about it. It's one of those things that you can still do in the time of COVID. I dare say it might be a tiny bit better to do it on Zoom, to do it virtually than to do it in a room. What do you think, Oren?
I think there are definitely pluses and minuses. I think the big plus is it's probably easier to get buy-in, you know? Hey, you're at home quarantining. We're all at home. You want to hop on this Zoom and be part of this screenplay reading? So I think that's the huge plus. It's just convenient in a way. You know, even for us doing the podcast, we haven't done it in person for such a long time, and it's much easier for us to get guests because there's like literally everyone's just used to Zoom so much. It's just like schedule another meeting for late at night. I think the minus is A, you don't get to feel the room, you know?
As a counterpoint, I was able to look at all of my performers at once. And so when a joke was landing or when a set piece was building, I could see it on their faces in a way that I think under normal circumstances, I'd probably look to one or two people and like, or maybe bury my head in my script because I was nervous. But being able to just like look at everyone all at once, you can kind of clock a little bit more of like how unanimous is this sentiment right now amongst the group. Whereas I think that I probably would have checked in with people, fixated on one or two people, been like, oh, they like it or they hate it. And that would have made my mind up about that beat one way or the other. Whereas like I got a bigger picture, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I guess in person you could put the performers next to each other and take a step back.
Yeah, I always do. But still, I think it's a lot harder to look at, you know, six faces all at once or however many people you have.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's interesting. I mean, the other thing is obviously just the distraction quotient. When you have people at your house or wherever you're doing a table read, they're not on their phone. They're not looking at anything else. No one's yelling at them. Their dogs aren't peeing on their foot or whatever happens. So yeah, but so I think it averages out to be, I mean, I've never done it, so you've done it now, I think, multiple times, but it seems to me like it would average out to be about equivalent pre-COVID and during COVID.
I think it may net positive, but worth it no matter what.
Yeah, for sure.
And maybe just to kind of take an even bigger step back, typically what I'll do is like, you know, you kind of, once you get the screenplay into a place where it feels solid and that it needs to be, it would benefit from hearing it out loud and from getting notes from a number of people and maybe having a conversation about it afterwards. Typically, I'd just order a bunch of pizzas and like get a handful of friends. I'd get a person to read stage direction. I'd cast a few of the leads and then I'd have two or so other actors do all of the swing characters, the smaller characters who kind of come in and out, basically.
Right. I did think you could have sent us pizza to our houses.
I would love to like send people like a Starbucks card or something.
No.
Not you, but the actors. Do you know what I mean? Like the people who are working. Well, I feel like it is nice to say thank you to them a little bit.
I mean, I guess just the counterpoint to that is I do think it's more fun to be part of a table read than to observe a table read. Like
that's true. That's true. You're practicing your craft more actively, I think.
Have you ever been to a Passover Seder? Potentially the world's first table read initiated 3,000 years ago where a bunch of people sit around a table and we all read the story of Moses emancipating the Israelites out of Egypt. It's kind of like a table read. And even if you're falling asleep, when it's your turn, you're like, oh, hey, it's my turn to read.
Pay attention. Watch how good
I read. Yeah, so what was your... You've done a bunch of table reads at this point.
Yeah, I mean, between myself and my wife, you know, we like to put stuff up on its feet as soon as we can, because I think you learn so much about how an audience is going to react to it, what things are working. And also, there's just nothing to compare that white hot feeling of shame and discomfort of like something bombing. And that's a feeling that you just have to like dive into, you know, like you don't put something up on its feet before it's ready, but you learn what's not working really quickly. And you try your hardest instinctually to avoid it from there on out.
Yeah, that's interesting. We had, remember, Zach Lipovsky and Adam Stein, who made this movie called Freaks that played at TIFF. They told us that they had done like 17 table reads or something, and their script started as total crap and ended up, you know, at the Toronto International Film Festival. So somehow those table reads really
that's some good friendship right there. There's some, that's a lot of good. 17 table reads is
I'm guessing they recast a little between table reads.
Yeah. I mean, I think my cast had some fun, but I don't think that they'd be down for 16 more Saturday afternoons. I will say one other thing, a takeaway, if you were thinking of mounting your own table read, the person who reads stage directions, which I recommend is not you, because you're putting your own spin on things.
I was actually thinking about it during your table read, because when I did that show, Miss 2059, one of the writers was reading the stage direction, and he used to be a writer's assistant on a bunch of TV shows, and he would be the one that was reading the stage direction, and he was really good at evoking tone through reading, and he would like set people up, and he was super fast, and it kind of, he kept this really high energy, but he wasn't reading it for feedback. It was like we were doing the table read with the actors right before the shoot, so departments could ask questions and stuff.
It is the hardest, most thankless part. Like, no one gets a laugh when they're reading stage directions. Like, no one gets to show their stuff as a good actor or anything like that. And also, it's a way for you to understand how things will read to a reader. You know, like, what sentences do they stumble over? What feels natural? What feels a little clunky? It's really valuable if it's not you, but also that you have a good friend who is able to like put a little energy behind it. And also you should tell them to read fast.
Yeah. You know, what would be cool is, so, you know, in the sign language interpreting world, like if you are hiring an interpreter to interpret an event or something, but they either have a max of 20 or 30 minutes that they can work at a time. So if you're going to have like a 2-hour event, you bring two of them and you swap them out every 30 minutes, let's say, because it's very exhausting to not only are you doing all this mental work, but you're also kind of moving your hands at super speed and you're kind of trying to listen to everyone and interpret, and you're going both directions. So I wonder if having like the person that's reading the scene description, like if you're like, okay, first 30 pages, like switch every 30 pages, two people.
Could be kind of a fun thing. Yeah. I mean, I think you do land in a little bit of a groove. But I don't know. That person, they're doing you a real solid, so don't take it for granted, that's for sure.
Do you have any other tips for table reads? Like, do you think people need to read the actors should read the script before the table read?
I asked them to come in cold. I didn't want them to read the script. And partially because there's like a little bit of a mystery element to this story, so I wanted to kind of track and clock, does the audience know what I want them to know at any given time, basically? And so that was important for me. But I did give them character descriptions that were super, super quick and hopefully helpful early on.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, you had a great cast too.
Yeah, I was really, really lucky. My cast was really wonderful.
Yeah, I feel like I have always just kind of been a little scared of a table read.
Oh, it's terrifying. Yeah.
It's like you said, it's like you're putting it all out there and people in real time judging what you wrote, you know, in front of your face. But it does seem super valuable. Yeah.
I mean, also, you know, not this time, but I think the time before with a different movie, I worked very hard on the script, but it was not the sole writer. It was someone else's script, and then we kind of tweaked it. And I remember him being really frustrated and upset because a lot of jokes didn't land. And the actor that I had brought in to play the lead had like a huge YouTube following, was like undeniably very funny, like super, super funny. And so I was like, look, man, the jokes aren't working on the page. So it's like, it's not the actor, it's us. And I think that that can be.
Was it Snoop Dogg?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So look, he's not a traditionally trained comedic performer, but he's been on stage for, what, 30 years at this point? No. But, you know, I think it is easy to be like, well, if they'd done a better job of reading my script. But, like, it's the same point as, like, having someone else reading stage direction. No one is... You can't walk in there and tell people how to read your screenplay. They're just going to get an email and crack it open to decide whether or not they want to make your movie. And so it's all going to be there on the page. And look, there are limitations to, like, someone's imagination or skill. Reading a screenplay is a challenging and unique thing to do, but that excuse only lasts you for so long.
Yeah. Well, it definitely seems valuable to invite, like, some friendly people to, like, when my wife was in part of Groundlings and going through the program there, you always want to invite some really good laughers to your shows.
You know, it's funny, this group, I don't think there was one good laugher.
Oh yeah, she was really good.
Yeah, yeah. But like, I realized in the moment, I was like, oh no, I invited all that's funny people. And I'm the worst. I'm like the most that's funny.
Yeah.
Like, of anyone.
Well, you had a chat also in Zoom, and I thought that was helpful to point out.
Did you like that? Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was like an easy way to say like, oh, I like this or I like that or this doesn't make sense. But it was kind of just Liz and me, Liz Manischel and me writing in there. So, and then I kind of just like took it easy. Also, I realized I was kind of like poking fun at the scene description reader. And then yeah. I felt bad because I kind of know him and I thought it was,
he
you
could
know,
take it. It's okay.
I thought he could take it. But then I would realize like how much work he was doing. And I was like, oh, now like, I'm just like making fun of him for,
you're like, oh,
I just seem like such a jerk.
Busting his chaps while he's also trying to slog his way through this screenplay. The other thing actually that is really nice about doing a table read is that that is a very external, very public deadline. So I reached out 2 weeks ago and said, hey, everybody, you know, I'd love for you to read this role or whatever.
Oh, and the script wasn't ready yet?
And the script was not done. No. I mean, it was close. It was close. But I knew there was I still had a checklist of like scenes that I wanted to tweak. I was like about 2/3 of the way through like kind of a quick little polish, you know, so it forces you to get it ready because you have to send it to people so that they can all read it out loud at the time that you schedule. So it's a nice external deadline, which I think can be really motivating for people and was for me.
For sure. And do you feel like you got a lot out of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You always do. And I think that, you know, sometimes it takes a little bit of time to look back on it and realize what you wanted to tweak. But yeah, I got a lot out of it. So I recommend it, everyone. If you decide to put up a table read of your own, drop us a line. Leave us a voicemail, 262-SHOOT-1. You could shoot us an email at justshootitpod@gmail.com.
If you need Matt to read all the scene description, he's available.
That is not true. That is reserved only for my enemies. I'm quite bad at it. But do let us know.
Well, cool. Before we talk to Natasha, I just wanted to remind people that we have a Patreon page. It's patreon.com/justshootitpod. And if you feel like you get anything out of this podcast, if you enjoy hearing about film once a week, every Thursday, I mean, we've been putting this out every Thursday for like 4 years. I don't know. I mean, I know we weren't that consistent.
I definitely have multiple memories of being in an airport on Thanksgiving morning, uploading the episode.
What, now you're saying Thanksgiving always falls on a Thursday?
Thanksgiving.
So anyway, if you have enjoyed being on this journey with us, either as of recent or for many years, and you feel like just chipping in for some of the editing and some of the other things we do, you can go to patreon.com/justshootitpod, give us $1 a month, $2 a month, $4, $10 gets you a hat, $20 gets you a t-shirt.
Whoa.
$500 gets you to be the EP of my next feature film. Just kidding.
$500 I will definitely read your
scene description.
Scene description as a table read. But
Matt will give you the $500 for that opportunity.
Yeah, there you go.
Nah, you don't need to give us $500.
Yeah, please don't. That would be
the $10 is my favorite tier. Anyway, patreon.com/justshootitpod. And we appreciate you listening, regardless of whether you're a patron or not. And now, on with the show. Hey folks, we're interrupting this incredible episode of the podcast to tell you about a new sponsor that we're working with, Front Row Insurance Brokers. One of the challenges of being a filmmaker is that there's a lot of risks that we take, and we really just want to focus on making good stuff. So what if there was a company that could take those risks, manage them for us while we are being artists?
That's right. Front Row Insurance Brokers arranges film production insurance to cover the risks associated with your production. They cover features, TV shows, documentaries, commercials, music videos, webisodes, basically anything you can watch on big, medium or phone-sized screens.
Yeah, Front Row will help you focus on your artistic vision by transferring all the risks to them and minimizing your production hazards. And they cover any budget from $2,000 all the way up to $200 million. There's nothing that's too small or too big.
If you are shooting in Canada, use coupon code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF for $50 off your film production insurance. That's promo code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF to save $50.
And if you're shooting in the U.S., that same code can be redeemed offline by mentioning it to a broker, by email, or over the phone.
It's like a cool password if you're in the U.S. That's JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF.
Check them out. Let us know how it goes. Well, Natasha, you've had your second feature debut at the infamous 2020 South By Film Festival.
The South By that never was, yes.
Yes, the South bye-bye.
Ironically, your film is called Lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
I'm sure that joke is as funny this time around.
We still got lucky. We still got lucky this year, but we didn't. It didn't feel great in early March. We'll put it that way. But we didn't know what was to come. South By getting canceled was sort of the canary in the coal mine. Actually, it was a few days before like Tom Hanks got sick and the NBA closed down, and it was like then the rest of the country was like, oh shit, this is for real, for real. But all the South By, we were already like in mourning. So.
To me, I feel like South By was like the signal for me. I was like, oh, okay. I guess
because it was on the edge, right? They were like deliberating. Should we cancel? Should we not cancel?
For a long time. Yeah. And people were dropping out. It was actually really quite depressing and almost a relief when they just canceled it because, you know, they as a filmmaker, right, they give you your calendar. And it's like all the different like AV Club and Hollywood Reporter and all the people who are going to talk to you and do the thing. And you just look at the calendar and just see things like dropping off.
Oh, you mean like they sent you a link, like a digital calendar.
People canceled. Yeah.
Like the only thing I'm going to be on is Just Shoot It. Yeah. We'll pass on this.
I would have been honored. I would have loved that. But in the end, there was zero things happening.
We have spoken to quite a few South By 2020.
Yeah,
filmmakers.
This year in particular, I feel like we've had a lot of South By.
We've got time to chat.
Yeah, there you go.
Can you give us the log line for Lucky?
Yeah, my log line is terrible. I definitely need to do that before the movie comes out. But basically, the movie is a horror satire starring Bria Grant, who is brilliant. And it follows a self-help book author who basically finds herself in a home invasion scenario night after night. And there's a man who's coming to kill her. And basically the movie just goes off the rails from there. And the world around her really starts to distort. And it's more of an examination of, you know, the sort of Twilight Zone experience that she goes into using the home invasion slasher movie as the skeleton of it. But we're sort of playing with other themes.
Just as a clarification, when you say that it happens over and over again, it's not in a time loop situation.
It's not a time loop, but it does sort of have that rhythm of every night he's coming back, he's coming back, he's coming back, and then it gets crazy sort of out
like
of
Nightmare
that.
On Elm Street a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of DNA of sort of 80s horror movies in there, although it definitely goes its own direction. So.
I'm curious, are there other little bits of DNA sprinkled throughout like other 80s movies or other films in general that Lucky kind of draws inspiration from?
So Bria Grant wrote the script. The lead in the movie also was the writer on the movie. And she actually was in the Rob Zombie Halloween movies. She really is a horror scream queen in her own right.
Icon,
really.
You could say.
Yeah, for sure. And so I think a lot of that sort of scream queen DNA is in there. I would say, you know, for me, definitely Scream. The movie Scream.
Boy, I don't know the last time people watched Scream. It's a masterpiece.
I feel like people have been talking about it a lot lately. Is there a reason?
Yeah, there's a reboot. Not a reboot. There's another one coming.
Oh, right. That's right.
So there's that to look forward to. But yeah, so definitely a lot of those things. But again, we really didn't, when we were going into production, we didn't set out to create any intentional homage, which is why I say it's in the DNA of it, you know, and we're really working within the bones and in the skin of a slasher, you know, and then doing our own story within that, those sort of bones, as I was saying. So.
Would you, I know plenty of people can't maybe cringe at this term, but I think it's a compliment. Would you call it elevated genre? Is that a thing? Natasha's doing a very polite job. Smiling.
Why would anyone take offense to elevated
Well,
genre?
Because it's the same as like a graphic novel and comic books. Comic books aren't bad. Well, genre movies aren't bad.
Yeah.
Mean to diminish the other, you know, works, basically.
Yeah. And I think a lot of genre is elevated in different ways. So, yes, in a lot of ways, certainly we are taking the genre and sort of discussing elevated concepts within it, right? So we really see the film as a conversation starter. So you go into the movie, you can almost be laughing a little bit at the more comedic elements of it. And then sort of by the end of the movie, you realize, okay, there's a conversation to be had here. There's a larger conversation. So sure, in that way that you're, you know, elevating the conversation, and then hopefully the conversation will continue after people have turned off their TVs or left the theater or whatever it is. And I think that sure, if you want to call that elevated, yes.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Artsy fartsy genre is good too.
It's not, you know? Artsy fartsy. It's no, certainly it's not. My first film is artsy fartsy, but and I don't shy away from artsy fartsy by any means. But no, Lucky is a lot of fun, and yeah, sure, elevated.
Great. So okay, so I just want to point out that your writer star's name Bria.
Bria. Mm-hmm.
That's the city I'm from. We pronounce it Brea.
Oh.
But that's where I grew up.
What so city is that? Cool. Where is that?
Brea. It's in Orange County.
Oh.
Next to Fullerton and Anaheim. So how did Bria come to you? Your first movie, I haven't seen it, but I watched the trailer, and it's also, it feels sci-fi turn, like that veers into horror. Was that kind of what put you on her map, your first movie?
Yeah, we kind of met each other socially just by being in the genre scene. When I moved out to LA, I was really just lucky to have her as a friend. We just sort of knew each other from the network, basically. Like, the horror scene is pretty small.
Can I dig into that for a second? So yeah. You made this horror
film. It's more
film.
Sci-fi, more sci-fi, I would say, with some horror elements and some horror actors, but yeah.
But importantly, maybe you're kind of at the same festivals. It's the same
circuit. Like the Fantastic Fest type of, bloody disgusting
vibe.
Type of. And so you're in New York, and then you move to LA, and because you kind of knew people that work in that genre in New York, you automatically kind of have like a little bit of a network in LA when you're
Yeah, for sure. I think for sure. And that might be something, I know you guys are in comedy. It's sort of a similar vibe where we do kind of know each other and there's a small-ish scene. I also signed with a manager off of my first film. So when I moved to LA, he also helped introduce me to a lot of people. And then
He was like an LA-based manager?
He's LA, yeah. He's LA-based. And then the distributor of the film also was just really in the scene and in the world. So just basically through those sort of key members of the film's team, I started to get to know people, and then, yeah, just ended up hanging out.
That's awesome. I know it sounds really obvious. Sorry to keep interrupting you, but we hear a lot of people that are like working in film in other places, and they move to LA and they have a really hard time kind of jump starting a network. And they're like, Oren, Matt, what should we do? How do we
and
build
we're
a network?
Like, but take improv classes,
yeah.
Right? You know,
go to UCB.
Yeah. I get it. LA can be very lonely. I get it. I'm from New York. I grew up in New York, and It's just such a different, you can go outside of your house and meet people, and LA is certainly not like that. So I think I had an advantage, because of those things I listed, the festivals and representation and the distributor and all that kind of stuff gave me a sort of backdoor entry, like literally sometimes just going to parties and people already being familiar with my work because it had done the festival circuit or whatever it is. So yeah, I think that is really helpful if you're a filmmaker, being able to, you know, hot swap into a new community in that way is good.
And also the horror community, you know, people are aware of each other's films in a way that I think sometimes that's not necessarily the case in like web media or whatever, you know, like you do have, you know, cachet when you can say, oh, I made this movie and people have seen it. That
horror
means
people watch movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not true for all film communities.
And they'll watch movies that don't have like huge megastars.
There's a thriving independent horror scene. And yeah, people do consume for sure.
Yeah. What about sci-fi people? Do they watch movies or is it a little...
Yeah, it was tricky. Just, I think we're just, it's, they're very rare. There's a hell of a lot more horror movies than there are sci-fi movies because sci-fi is really fucking expensive. So, yeah, we get sort of like, looped in often with the horror community, but I have to say, like, I have really always loved horror and I love very specific aspects of horror. And so I think when I initially brought my first film out, which is a very sort of dreamy sci-fi, it has some horror elements to it, but it really is not violent. It's not bloody. It's not really any of those things. It's more like a visceral existential horror. I was a little worried because I said, I don't know if these people are going to accept me or my film or any of these things, but I think the horror community is vast and it's multifaceted and there's many different little pockets that you can find yourself in. So I was very grateful.
Do you think you need to be like a fan of horror to, like, were you a fan before you came in or is it something that you kind of discovered once?
Oh no, I was a fan before for sure. For sure. For years. I mean, even as a kid, I loved it. You know, seeing Alien for the first time or seeing The Shining for the first time or seeing Nightmare on Elm Street, you mentioned. I mean, that stuff is really burned into your brain forever. So, and I think most of us would say it for sure. I think most working horror people, especially in the indie scene, you really have to love it because it's not easy and the budgets are low and the scheduling is brutal. So if you don't get excited and you don't have fun with that kind of filmmaking, I don't really know why you would do it.
I kind of think that is true for all filmmaking. I always joke it's easier to, like, you could just, you know, do real estate or something. Like, if
yeah,
you don't
if you
love
have any
it,
other skills
or go to law school, you don't have to like your job and you still make so much money.
Yeah. What's that like?
I don't know. But I do think it's interesting because you hear of people that get into horror because they hear that it's like an easy way, like you can make a low budget horror movie that's successful, right? Because you don't typically need like these giant movie stars. And so I feel like a lot of people make horror films that aren't that into horror and they probably make not very good horror films. But
yeah, you encounter those folks every once in a while, but I don't think they really lock in or engage with the community or the festivals, or they're not really taking advantage of what the horror scene has to offer. So they kind of, I imagine they kind of come and go and that's fine, but.
Based off of, you mentioned what the horror scene has to offer. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because I think that there's probably a lot of listeners at home who are longtime horror fans, right? Or sci-fi fans, genre fans in general. We don't have a ton of that style of director on, actually, to be frank. And Oren and I aren't really experts in it. So I'm just curious about maybe some of the more concrete elements that you found to be especially helpful or unique even?
Well, purely from a creative perspective, it's the opportunity to paint in bold colors. So if you're a filmmaker that likes exploring everything that a cinematographer can bring to the table, right? You look at a film like Suspiria and the opportunity there to play with color or lighting in a way that a drama would never really allow you to. So you're able to really turn the expressionism dial all the way up. And if that excites you as a filmmaker, then it's a great opportunity for that. For me, I'm really interested in world building. That's sort of why my first love was science fiction, for sure. Again, even the first horror movie that I fell in love with is Alien, which is a sci-fi horror, right? And I love the blend of the two genres. So the opportunity to build a world, right? To make a film that not only is a reflection of your world, but to envision a different version of your reality, or a better version, or a scarier version, or whatever you want to do. Again, it's that heightened expressionism sort of to the max. And then career-wise, I mean, I think to speak practically and logistically, like, how many indie level micro projects are you going to be able to stretch your wings as far as filming action sequences, as far as filming visual effects, practical effects, special effects makeup? If this is stuff that you want to keep doing, if you want to keep moving into that sci-fi world, horror world, action world, which is very much a part of our industry, then this is a great place to cut your teeth and try it out and say, like, oh, this is how you mix blood, right? Like, this is the best way to do it. And maybe it doesn't really fucking matter in the end. If you just want to be a director that sort of like sits around and doesn't do too much, collects your paycheck and goes home. But if you like getting your hands dirty and knowing,
which
how...
I don't think there are a lot of directors.
Yeah, I would love to be introduced to one. we've been doing the show for 5 years. I don't think we've met one yet.
Yeah. Well, cause you're choosing interesting people, I'm sure. But, you know, there is just an opportunity to get your hands dirty, to really understand on a granular level at an early level. So you don't have to get to Spielberg status to be playing with the big toys. You can do it at a micro level or an independent level. And I was personally very excited by that. And even with my first little sci-fi, you know, the opportunity to feel more and more confident, even my college film, I was working with visual effects and, you know, really starting to feel more confident with action sequence, how to build an action sequence, how to build a horror sequence, how to show somebody having a terrible accident. All those things are the building blocks of how a film in that space is made. So I think that's an opportunity.
Love it. So great. Yeah, that there's so many incredible nuggets in that what you just said that I think our listeners are really going to click with, actually. It's great. I love it.
I want to just go back for a minute. So you went to NYU. Did you go to Tisch Film School?
I did go to Tisch, yeah.
So, and your first feature out of film school was Imitation Girl, right? That
it was not out of film school. I worked. So I graduated in 2010 and ended up doing a lot of branded content right out of school. So working with clients and making little short form pieces while also doing short films and sort of like narrative stuff and continuing to explore the genre side of things. But what happened was we built our production company off of that branded content work. And because I had that...
Like you and some friends or partners or...
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I have two partners and then we have a network of freelancers that we work with closely. So we sort of build or scale down our teams depending on what the job needs.
And do you always direct or do you produce also and... do other things?
I'll produce every once in a while. Right out the gate, we were kind of all jacks of all trades. My partners were actually, one was a cinematographer and one was a lighting guy. And I myself had a background in music and sound design. And I was also ACing at the time. So I was an assistant camera at the time as well to sort of like make money. And
you're a composer too, right?
Yeah, I wasn't doing as much professionally. I was more just like working for myself. The music is a whole nother side of myself that I try to keep a little more just for me. So I wasn't really like trying to bank on that. Anyway, long-winded way of saying we were all jacks of all trades. And then as we were able to sort of move to bigger scale stuff, the cinematographer is now, he's basically like our producer, head producer. And I do most of the directing, but we farm out our directing a lot as well, because I'm not always the right fit for whatever is happening, or I'm not available or whatever it is. But because we had built that, and for a few years, we had been expanding our network of teams. So this is like camera people, lighting people, sound designers, post people who we were paying pretty regularly with this branded work. When the time came for me to come knocking on their door and say, hey, would you like to work three times as hard for way less money? They were game, you know, they were up for it because there was a lot of trust there and there was a lot of loyalty and care and we knew each other and we were cool like that. So
this was for your feature.
That was for Imitation Girl. And so I bring it up because sometimes you're building something and you're not exactly sure what's going to build to, but Imitation Girl would never be possible without the production company because we were able to tap into those teams. We were able to tap into money just straight financing for the film.
And what do you mean by that? Like, because you guys made money, like the company paid for it, or you knew
not
people
entire,
that were...
Well, both. So partially was from the company itself, just putting straight into the movie as equity. And then others was, you know, relationships. We had several EPs who knew us from our other work, or we had produced other small films or short films with them, and they were ready to take the leap with us.
And when you say take the leap with us, were you basically offering them like equity to be part of the movie?
It was a combination of different things, but yeah, it basically part of the film, right? So like points on the back end. Yes, they were coming in as EPs.
Investment
basically.
Opportunities and a couple different flavors.
Exactly. Yeah. And these are small amounts of money in the grand scheme of things, but at the time it wasn't what we needed to make the film happen. So yeah, and I think all those things are a product of those 5 years. Yeah, because we shot the film in 2015. We started filming in 2015. We finished it in 2016. There was like a 6 month gap between filming. But yeah, so I think the different aspects of your career can actually tie together, I think, if you can set yourself up in that way to have that, you know.
Yeah,
access.
Well, what I love about that is, you know, that's a thing that we have tried to talk about and illustrate on the show. I think it's funny, I didn't realize this until now, but like, I think the three of us all have relatively parallel paths, but in different scenes, right? And a thing that, you know, I think some people, you know, look at Oren and I, who were doing like a lot of commercial work or branded work, especially back in like 2010, 2015, lot of branded work out there. And it was, people would be like, well, no one would ever say selling out, because no one begrudges someone making money living their dream, but it's like, well, you're wasting your time, or why are you focusing on that, right? Like,
well, we had a major split in our company.
Interesting.
There was another member who ended up leaving the company because he wanted to focus on what he considered like the real art and whatever. And the rest of us were like, fuck that. We're here,
sure,
to get some
we
money.
Get paid, right? You know,
like rent's
NYU ain't
bro.
Cheap, right? So
yeah,
well, it is.
It ain't cheap. Yeah.
Yeah. It's something I struggle with all the time. Matt and I have talked about this, not on the podcast, but like my manager, my film and TV manager is like, he's like, all you do is commercials. Like, that has nothing to do with me. Like, what? He's like, tell me how I can help you, because I have nothing to do with these commercials. And I do wonder a lot of times, like, am I just like wasting all this time, like trying to make the best Quiznos commercial, you know?
No, because you need money. And also it's also not just the money, though. It's the opportunity to be on set and to be directing and to see yourself in that way and have that confidence. I know for me, it was huge.
Yeah, it's going to the gym, right? Like, you're figuring out how to do your job. And also, I think really to your point of having that network of trusted collaborators, not only who, you know, maybe owe you a favor here or there, but who you know you can trust, and you have that's loyalty, and also like a strong collaboration. You speak the same language, you know, you've put in the time together. You know, if someone were to say, hey, Natasha, do you want to have a brand new crew that you've never worked with before and go make a micro budget film? Or, you know, how about like a 5 years worth of crewing with these people and in the trenches, like learning what it's like to be stressed out with them, learning what they're great at, learning what things maybe they need to be improved, like, and then also learning from them, because they're not working with you 100% of the time. They're out in the field picking up all sorts of different tips and tricks from other directors, right? So
yeah, it's a great point.
You know,
mm-hmm. have you guys ever done that? Like, you work with a DP that you know has worked with like some other really great directors, and you're like, so you know, what would Sam Mendes do in this? Like, how, you know? Oh yeah, I just worked with this production designer that he's like Mark Forster's like commercial guy, and I'm like, what would Mark think about this set?
I have.
What did he say?
He's like, yeah, I can't tell.
I have the opposite, where I'm like,
I'll tell you.
I know Mark Forster would never make you cut this corner, but can you make this just 20% shittier and cheaper because we have to shoot? It's the worst feeling.
Like, recently taken that, like, just try to not think of the budget, not in a way where like I'm trying to, I want to get the most expensive things, but like, I'll just ask for stuff until people say we can't afford that.
Yeah, yeah. That's a learned behavior, though. Like, you're not going to do that on your first time. I mean, I don't know. Maybe some people will, but I would.
Well, you're kind of a dick if you do it on your first time.
Yeah, that's like a bold move. But yeah, I think that that's confidence, right? And that's sort of knowing the ropes enough to know when you can push and when you can't push.
I think there's also personality traits to it, too. You know, like, I think Oren and I are both good boys. Do you know what I mean? Teacher's pet, people pleasers a little bit.
More like,
maybe me more than Oren.
Pushovers.
Yeah, but like, you know, and you slowly learn like being nice or like doing somebody a favor. If the job is to make a good spot and you know that it's going to make it worse, it's sort of your job to like make it good. That's it.
Yeah.
You know?
I will say, you know, since all of us, my partners at the company and myself, all came from the crew side, we didn't really come from being producers or being writers. We were all on set and, you know, having suffered through many terrible meals and overtime and all that. I think that gave us like a really special perspective on exactly what you're saying and always sort of having that perspective. But then for me, it was almost working backwards from that. So then saying, no, I am going to push for this. You are going to stay another hour. We are going to do this, you know, and I think, you know, relearning that is also just as important. It's maybe like super granular because I know a lot of people come from writing. Actually, in the horror scene specifically, a lot of people come from horror journalism and they're trying to sidestep. So they're like writing about horror. Or they write for like a horror magazine or something. And, you know, then they sidestep in and they actually have no set experience, really. You know, they know the genre really well. And so, you know, I think it's a balance between those two things. If
yeah.
That makes
yeah.
Sense.
Without a doubt. It is funny how you maybe the flip side of loving your crew and being like in the trenches with them is like you do cringe at the thought of like making somebody go into overtime or something or like making them do it again when they know that, you know, you don't want it to be a personal thing, obviously. But I think doing all the things that you mentioned before, of like taking care of them in the ways that are really important, makes them know that when you need another hour of overtime, it's because you need it.
Yeah, because you really do need it and you're not just bullshitting around. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have the successful first feature, right? You get distribution, you play festivals, you have the successful company, you have this whole crew that will kill themselves for you. What makes you then decide to throw that all away and move to LA?
That is a rosy interpretation of the last few years.
You missed his punchline, though. Why did you throw it all away to move to Los Angeles?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Why did I move to Los Angeles? My fiance is a director of photography. I'm a director. We were both really feeling like we were hitting a wall in New York.
You were in New York City, right? Like York, or like Brooklyn or somewhere.
Yeah, we were in Brooklyn. Yeah.
And where people are.
Where people are, yeah.
Not
yeah,
like
yeah.
Long Island.
Or Woodstock or something.
There's a lot of people in Long Island. No,
like
I
a lot of film people?
No, that's true.
Oh, totally, yeah.
No, even in Brooklyn, you know, we really felt like we were hitting a wall with the work that we wanted to be doing and sort of the place that we kept finding ourselves. And also rent was really fucking expensive and LA was not as expensive. So
yeah,
we decided
and you get
to try
like 30%
really
more
hard.
Square footage, right?
Yeah, the space is nice.
Your one bedroom is only $2,500 a month.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, that's right. You're spending that, and you have two roommates mm-hmm. in New York.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So
I joke, but my brother, when he first moved to New York, lived in a closet, like a literal actual
yeah,
closet.
Yeah, he was probably paying a pretty penny.
Yeah,
for the honor,
yeah.
for the honor of
yeah,
living
yeah,
in
exactly.
a closet in New York. No, it's crazy. Yeah. It's absolutely crazy. I mean, New York has always been crazy, but it's bonkers. And now LA is getting expensive, but it was very difficult. It was very, very difficult. New York is our home. We will probably end up back there at some point. But it was time for us to move. My representation was in LA. So I mentioned my manager. And so it was sort of like opportunities were opening up and we felt like we were just booking a lot of flights.
Did you have
sense.
Any jobs lined up in LA? Like, was it like, or did you have like, let's wait till the end of the year? What was the thing that was like the marker?
He actually
was your fiance?
He booked two movies in a row in New York.
Oh.
So
and you were like,
I moved into LA by myself.
Wow.
Because he was working. But no, it was the movie. So I was releasing the film. So it was mostly like release stuff. And I guess that is still work, but it was a different kind of work. It was more...
Your first movie.
The first movie, exactly.
So was there this idea like, I have this movie out. It's doing well in the festivals. We have distribution. I should be in LA so I could take all these meetings and kind of try to level up.
It was part of that for sure. We actually didn't really, we made the move sort of in the middle of the festival thing. And I think I really wouldn't say it's entirely based on the movie. I think it was a long time coming kind of move that a lot of New York filmmakers feel like, okay, I'm going to go try it. I think especially if you're from the East Coast, you do kind of have this thing of, well, I should try it. I should get out of New York for a little bit.
Do you ever call it going back west?
Going back west?
Yeah. I used to get so annoyed when people were like, oh, you're going back east. I'm like, I was never there to begin with.
Oh, yeah, because you're from California. Yeah.
Yeah.
What an unusual...
From Brea.
...experience.
California.
Yeah. Oren from Brea. Yeah. Yeah, so I think it was, you know, the money being spent on all those JetBlue flights back and forth, and it was just getting a lot. And we were finding that we were waiting to get back to LA because we were like getting through our time in New York and the work in New York so that we could get back. And that's when we realized, okay, we need to flip this. And it was the right decision.
Did you have many peers who were in Los Angeles at the time also? Yeah. There's a kind of a 5-year brain drain cycle, I think, for people, right?
Yep. Absolutely. Two of my best friends actually moved out to LA this same week that we did from New York. So yeah, it was definitely, I didn't really have that like lonely LA.
That's awesome. Okay, so you have this movie, it's a hit movie, you got this hit manager, you move to the hit town.
It's all working out.
Hold on though, just for actual scale and like what sort of distribution did Imitation Girl get? Like, you know.
It was very small, very small. Yeah, yeah. We distributed with a very much an indie horror label. Which was honestly great for us because it was a very small movie and we were able to sort of not just get, you know, you get all the offers for like, you know, the slap it on VOD and you get an email from us once a quarter. But these guys I actually developed a relationship with, and the group that owned the label actually ended up financing Lucky. So all roads are connected.
So what, I guess I'm curious what, has your manager kind of helped you in any interesting way since you moved to LA?
Oh yeah, we're super tight. He's a real straight shooter kind of guy, which was good.
What's
for
that
me.
Mean? That he's like, no one's gonna buy this.
Yeah, he just says it like it is, which I really appreciate. Yeah, I think, you know, it's all the stuff, right? Like it's all the representative stuff. Like you do the water bottle tour, you do the whatever. And then, you know, he got me signed with my agency and that's great. And I'm very grateful. And all that stuff is gravy. But at the end of the day, what matters is like he's going to work with you, right? You have a common vision, a common goal, right? Like a language that you can understand with each other that is a little bit built out of the time that you spend together, but it's also an instinct, right? So it's like, he likes the stuff that I make and I like his taste. And so that at the end of the day is what's really important and what I appreciate. So I think I got lucky. I didn't do the manager tour. He just like found me on Twitter and was like, hey, do you have a manager? And I was like, what's a manager? And then that was it.
Well, so how was he involved at all in Lucky, like helping you cast, finance, anything?
He helped a fair amount. It kind of came as a finished package. Like I said, it came with financing. It came with Bria already attached.
And she just like approached you because you were friends. Like, was it like, hey, I wrote this script. Do you want to check it out? How did that
happen? The company actually sent it to me. One of the producer that distributed Imitation Girl, my first film, brought me this script. So he knew me from Imitation Girl and we had formed a friendship, again, trust, right? We're talking about trust and honesty and loyalty and all that good stuff. So that was there, right? And so he sent it to me actually and said, hey,
so you're talking about
like
trust and loyalty and all that stuff. It kind of reminds me of like a NXIVM type of organization. Is that what?
Funny you should bring that up. Do you want to hear my NXIVM story? Is that
sure? Before we started rolling, we got a little bit of a spoiler. There's a slight NXIVM.
It came up. It came up because there's multiple documentaries about it. No, I went to high school near Albany, so had a lot of friends up there and whatever. So back in New York, years after I had left Albany, I went out to sushi with a friend, and she was like, "Oh, do you ever watch Smallville?" And I was like, obviously, I watched Smallville. Smallville fucking rocks. And they're like, "Oh, Allison Mack is going to meet us at the restaurant." And I was like, "Okay, rad. Like, she's the best part of Smallville. Let's go." And she proceeded to pitch us on a creative retreat. So I'm doing air signs here because obviously that is not what it was. That was for like creative women. And she's like really pitching us hard. She's like, "I can tell that you're like really motivated and all this stuff." And meanwhile, my like spidey sense is tingling. I had two uncles in cults in the 70s.
Okay? Oh, wow.
So I'm like, I ones see
we would
bullshit.
Know, like famous ones or no?
Yeah, it's called Children of God. I think they're called something else now. It's like a wackadoodle Christian abusive thing. But so my spidey sense was like tingling. I was like, this is fucking weird. This is some cult bullshit. And so I did not.
It's funny because there's probably a way to pitch that doesn't sound cultish. Like if someone's like, "Hey, we're doing this creative retreat. You want to come?" And be like,
"She was good. Yeah, she was good." I was like, "Oh, that sounds nice." And then we talked about like upstate New York a little bit. I'm looking this up. I know that maybe you can take a photo of it, but that's from that night.
I don't think we need to reveal her
phone.
We'll
blur it out. That's so good.
Oh, that's for sure not her phone number anymore. She's in
prison.
Yeah,
she doesn't have a phone anymore.
There's no cell phone.
Did she get sentenced already?
She's in state.
Spoiler alert, I'm only on episode 5 of Vow, guys.
Sorry. Yes, she's in state prison. Anyway, so that's my NXIVM story. And then I think like when all this shit went down, my friend who had invited me out was on page mm-hmm. 6 and I'm in page 6 as like
oh
the
that's
friend.
Excellent
they're like me and a friend so that was my brush yeah that was my brush with
you
page
know
six,
I mean so. All, like a lot of the Mark and Bonnie stuff is in our neighborhood. Like there's a lot like I recognize the
in
building.
Los Feliz
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on Vermont. Yeah not too far from we yeah.
Well, there's some weird culty vibes here though. I'm not gonna
man
gonna lie.
My dream is to be invited to a cool cult.
You should have been there.
I've only been invited to the Landmark Forum.
Mm-hmm. I have been invited to Landmark
Kabbalah.
Forum as well. That's not very cool.
And just like very borderline Scientology, but nothing like as exclusive as NXIVM. So was Lucky significantly bigger than Imitation Girl?
Not by a lot, actually.
So kind of assume just like a slight bump up.
Yeah, it was like a small bump up in budget, but it's still micro, still tiny. Still very difficult. We shot it in 15 days.
Are you allowed to say how tiny?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. It was about $250,000.
Okay. So on the very big end of micro.
Yeah, it's like the decent end of
yeah,
micro.
Still ultra low.
Ultra low.
Yeah, by $100,000.
Yeah, we shot it in 15 days, which was not ideal. All in LA.
Where did you shoot it? Oh, LA.
Yeah, LA. We were Altadena, Pasadena, Highland Park.
Natasha, I'm curious. So Lucky, you know, South by Southwest, you know, a little bit of a false start, it felt like at first, but like things have turned out well for a lot of the films at South by Southwest, and we've had a lot of those filmmakers on, but not in a while, frankly. So it's been announced that Lucky is going to be on Shudder sometime next year. Very excited about that. Can I ask, has your life changed? What happened at post Lucky? What's next for you, I guess is what I'm getting at.
My life has changed a lot because there's a pandemic. So I don't know if there's an answer to your question that doesn't include the pandemic, because I don't know what it's like to have a movie at South By in normal times and to be able to go. Yeah, the network has expanded. I'm looking at, I think, more interesting projects. I think that people take me a little bit more seriously, incrementally, right? I mean, I think it's still a small horror movie. And at the end of the day, there is quite a lot of, I don't want to say prejudice, but people do look down on genre movies for sure as being sort of like cheap little
right,
slasher
but it's
movies.
Not, but it's a South By genre movie, right?
Right, so which I feel gives like there's, you...
Yeah, there's a cachet.
Yeah.
Especially, I think, in a genre film, because South By is the kind of ultimate the ultimate mainstream festival you want to get into with a genre film, I would think.
Yeah, we were super amped. I mean, I was so fucking happy when we found out, because we were rushing and we got in on a rough cut. And I just thought, oh, there's no way we're getting in. And so when we got in, I was very, very excited. And I was frankly very, very sad when it didn't happen. And I think that's a bummer, because even if I do another film that goes to South By, it won't be that. It won't be like, this is my first film in South By. You know, it won't have that.
You don't get a do-over. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. It'll be like another project, you know, where I'm going to be in a different place in my life and all that. So
can I ask a weird technical question about that submission? So when you submit this rough cut to South By, what do you tell them, like, about it? Like, what do you say about the rough cut? Like, what do you qualify?
Oh, so you say what specifically? So we were, I think we said, it wasn't a rough cut. It was like a fine cut, I would say. Temp music. So like no score, but we actually used all of our temp music was scored by our composer. So I used music from other of his work in. So like at least the vibe was, they could understand what the vibe was. Temp VFX, no sound design. Obviously, that's a really big one. Temp color. So we just like listed out to our contact, you know, this blah, 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 blah. Here's what's rough. And I guess they saw, you know, they're able to see enough.
I want to go back just a beat to talk about why, for listeners at home, why South By is a bigger deal specifically for a genre film, right? Because there's a lot of really wonderful genre festivals out there, right? Like we talked about, like Fantastic Fest is great. You know, like there's a lot of like Fantasia, other festivals that start with F, and also there's like midnight programs for some more mainstream festivals. But the difference between getting accepted into a mainstream festival and getting accepted to a really wonderful genre festival is kind of the thing that we were talking about before when I was talking about quote unquote elevated genre. It's a harsh reality of the way that some people see genre film in general. Do you want to talk? I think you get what I'm getting at. You want to talk about it a little bit more?
Yeah. Well, people, non-horror fans will go to South By.
Right. Or like, I mean, even Hollywood people, right? Like agents and managers and all those people.
Distributors.
I think people are coming around to like Fantastic Fest and all those are these huge successful festivals, but
there's still,
but South By is a name everybody knows.
Yes. Yes. It's considered, I mean, what do they call it? Like the top six or something. What I think is extra special about South By, to be honest, is that it does still sort of have that scrappy indie aspect to it as compared to like a Toronto or Cannes or something like that, which is extremely polished. And believe me, I would be fucking thrilled to have a movie play at Cannes, but there is that sort of scrappiness to it that I think is fun for a horror movie. Like your movie can play at like 11 p.m. and people will be drunk and on 6th Street in Austin. And it like, it still feels like a party is my point, which is what's so fun about the genre festivals. Cause the genre festivals, you go and you see all your friends, you know, it's like a few times a year you get to go to Montreal and see all your friends. I think it still has that vibe. But it is sort of that the viewers who are there, the audience, there's big execs, there's people who are you can take a meeting with them and that can really be good for your career. So, yes.
Did you write your first movie?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then so what's for your next movie or TV show or whatever is next for you? Is that like what's your kind of balance between directing and writing?
I love both. Writing takes a hell of a lot longer. You can read somebody else's script and give them notes much faster than generating a really super solid script of your own. So I sort of see it as like the script writing wheel is turning and it turns at its own pace and I don't rush it. But then I can really buzz through a lot of scripts in a week, you know, like I can really go through. So, you know, you keep them both going. But then, of course, the quality is that, right? Like the script that you're doing is 100% what you want to do. That is your movie. Whereas these other scripts, yeah, you can read, you know, a bunch of them and be winding through them. But 90% of them is not going to be something that you connect to. So, you know, at the end of the day, they maybe kind of catch up with each other. And in the end, you know, your project is the one that's actually going to go. But with that said, I'm perfectly happy going either path. I think you just keep, you know, I kind of think of it like pots on the stove. And I think as filmmakers, we have to do that, where we're talking about our commercial lives as well, which like maybe our reps don't always understand that we have that whole other side of ourselves where it's like, I'm maintaining a commercial career, you know, and trying to keep that going and that sort of bustling in its own way. And then on the scripted side, you know, you have your babies, you have your scripts that you're sort of trying to grow and hopefully nourishing them in the way that they need to be nourished. But also you have, you know, two or three other scripts that you really like that are maybe set up with a cool producer. You know, it has, there's other things about it that are exciting. I also really love some other writers in my life. And I think that their work is really good and that they're great collaborators. So I don't want to cut myself off to their creativity, you know, and I would love to be a part of their world as well. So it's really like all those different engines always pumping at the same time, which is exhausting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's just a portrait of a modern filmmaker also, though. You know, like I think independent film is a thing that makes you more desirable to TV producers or even like commercial producers. But you don't get rich off of indie films necessarily, right? But, you know, they nourish you in a different way. Whereas commercials, you know, you can find a way to love them, for instance, but they are there to give you some sustainability so that you can go out and do those indie films. So,
and not be stressed out about money. I mean, anxiety and stress is already part of our lives by proxy of what we do. So then to also be worried about paying your bills is crippling. And it really is going to block your creativity. It's going to block your ability to go and meet people, to have those conversations in a relaxed and confident way. So if you need to go do something else to pay your bills so that you're able to do those things, then that's what you have to do. You know, that's part of it. It's part of the gig.
Yeah. Are you kind of rebuilding your commercial stuff in LA also?
I'm really not.
I mean, it is a weird time.
I shouldn't have said that because I was like, definitely not something I'm focusing on. But actually, I've noticed that the commercial stuff is actually picking up pretty fast. I've actually been very busy the last few months. Labor Day?
Month, like, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, like Labor Day on, it's been pretty busy. I just did my first car commercial, which is a lot of fun.
Hey, congratulations.
Oh, cool.
Thank you.
Which car?
It's called the Genesis. It's Hyundai. Yeah, it's Hyundai's. Do you do a lot of car stuff?
I've done a little car stuff. I've pitched on Hyundai, which is why I know it rhymes with Sunday. And it's not Hyundai.
I know, definitely what Matt always says. Hyundai.
It drives me crazy.
Hyundai.
I drive one.
Extra embarrassing.
Okay. Yeah, they're not great.
But the Genesis is awesome because it's like secret Hyundai.
Yeah, I didn't know.
It's like, it doesn't say Hyundai on the car. It just, I've actually pitched on a Genesis thing years ago. But yeah, it's a nice car. It's like their luxury.
It was cool.
It's like their Lexus or whatever.
It was cool. Yeah, it was a cool experience. But I know I was saying like you keep all the engines going, but it is really hard. So there's definitely times where like the commercials are not a part of my day to day. And then there's other times where it comes in and you're like, great, I can do this. I can like switch gears and work on this and be really engaged. So it's not like always constant all the time. It's definitely, you know, dancing between, dancing between your identities as a filmmaker.
They're also quite cyclical, you know, like you were saying, things start picking up. It's because it's the end of the year and people are spending their budgets down. And then also,
it'll be quiet.
Yeah, it'll be quiet in February. The other thing is that they're short term. So turning down a 3-week gig isn't as devastating as, you know, because you're busy making a movie or something like that, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it will be in the feature space. I mean, you brought up TV. I would say that's one sort of blank spot in my career that I should sort of be focusing on expanding, because I think episodic directing is very interesting and a good way to sort of like make money and again, you know, go to the gym, as you say.
But it's like, especially if you as a filmmaker are someone that enjoys directing other people's writing as well as your own, it seems like a good
place. I have absolutely no interest in show running. Like, that seems crazy to me. But I think like popping in and popping out sounds really appealing. But I think my next project will be in the feature space.
And would you do another feature the same size as your last two features, or is there kind of a goal to always grow a little bit.
I would not. It's too hard. It's just, it's way too hard. You know, I think we've done it. You know, my team is incredible. We busted ass and we got our little movie into South By, and that's great. And there's nothing really else I have to say in the space, because the next steps now for me is to, again, we were talking about visual effects and practical effects and action sequences and learning to play with the tools. And I'm very interested in those things. And I think the limitations and the ceiling that you hit with a micro is just, it's sort of lost its, it doesn't entertain me anymore. It doesn't feel like a challenge. It doesn't feel like there's anything more to learn in this space. Now the next space is more interesting.
Yeah, but it's almost kind of like getting an undergrad degree, right? Like there's only so many of those you can live through before you're, I guess that's what you're saying, is like you kind of got a lot of value. You kind of got the most value you can kind of get out of a micro budget film. So
for me and yeah. Other people love the freedom of an indie, right? Like I get that. I totally get that. You know, you can go on, you can change the script, you can work with the actors. You have total, almost total freedom to do exactly what you need to do in that moment. And that goes away. I understand that it goes away, as you move up in tiers. However, I'm ready to make that trade and be able to, you know, spread my wings a little bit more in that space. So yeah. Yeah. I mean, never say never, but
yeah, I know. I was attached to this kind of like $200,000-ish film last year. And it was, I mean, I don't know. It kind of was like, if we could book a name, it would have gone up a little bit, you know, but it's still in that range where it's like, we'd get more money for a name, but we wouldn't get any more money for production. And I was just kind of honestly dreading it the whole time. I was kind of hoping it would never go, because I mean, I talked to Matt about it all the time. I talked about it on the podcast. I'm like, I just don't know. It's like, just going to be me, like being the art department. I don't know how we're going to do this. It's going to be impossible.
I think more realistically, you just end up being the VFX department, which is like, yeah. You know.
Or it just starts solving everything with VFX, and then it just looks like a really crappy movie.
Yeah, you don't want to do that either. It's really, it's draining. You know, it's completely draining on you as a person. You're going to lose money. You are going to lose money. And doing a movie like that. So, you know, if you give any shit at all, you will lose money. So yeah, I mean, there's only so many times you can frankly like afford to do that.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Well, thanks for telling us your story. I hope that wasn't a downer.
I think it was a downer.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's so many pieces of information that, look, it's practical, right? Like we just talked about the other ways that people make money and the ways that this micro budget films can be an investment in your career, right? And like you are living proof of that, right?
So making the first feature did change my life. That was a huge step forward for me in my career, and it was incredibly difficult. I worked at a coffee shop for like 6 months after that movie, just trying to recoup and pay something back to
coffee.
You know, pay some, yeah, exactly, like free pastries and shit. Like it's fucking hard, you know, and that is an investment. However, making your first movie, making your first micro is absolutely worth it. So, you know, you have to love it to get through it and you won't always love it. But I certainly have no regrets.
And you would have never gotten the second one without the first one. And now I think this is like an optimistic conversation is because you're like, I made my first one for nothing. I killed myself. I made my second one because people believed in me and it played South By. And now I know that the next one is going to be even bigger.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's it. Look, some people can like jump many, many ladders and like somehow skyrocket. For the rest of us schlubs, we have to work. We have to work our way up. And this is how you do it, you know, little by little, finding projects you love that can get financed. And yeah, I think moving forward.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Matt and I are professional schlubs, so we get it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, Natasha, this is great. Can you hang out and endorse with us?
Yes, of course.
Unpaid endorsements.
My unpaid endorsement is a podcast called Dead Eyes. It is great. I can't recommend it highly enough. So it is the long form interview and like pseudo journalistic pursuit of a comedian from New York, actually, or in the New York scene, named Connor Ratliff. You know, he has like a, he was at UCB a lot. He did a show where he like imitates George Lucas, and he was on the Chris Gethard show for a while. But he has a story that he's told for 20 years now, where he was cast in the show Band of Brothers, which was a big World War II epic show.
Oh yeah, I loved Band of Brothers. And
yes,
Tom Hanks was.
He told him his eyes looked dead.
Tom?
Sorry. Okay, go on. I haven't heard the story.
Oh no!
Tom Hanks calls him in, and he's cast. He's in London. Like they are gonna shoot, and then they have him audition again for Tom Hanks as kind of like a Hail Mary. Tom Hanks, it gets back to Connor Ratliff. Tom Hanks says, "We have to replace him. Connor has dead eyes." And so
that's so brutal.
So brutal. And he was obsessed with it for a long time. And so now it is a genuinely great, pretty cathartic podcast about him figuring that out, unpacking that for himself in a way that's like totally healthy. And he realizes is all about him and not about Tom Hanks making a business decision. But it's really funny, really great. I highly recommend it. Let me ask you two, because it's a thing I've been talking about with my friends. Would you use the term dead eyes or do you know what it means?
I mean, it assume just means like tired or like looking. No, I would never use it.
Dead in the eyes is what I've heard.
Yeah.
She's dead in the eyes, mm-hmm. or he's dead in the eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. Like no inner life. Maybe bad listening.
Like a zombie.
Yeah.
That's something you would say about a human being?
I wouldn't ever say, oh, that person has dead eyes, but I know what they mean. And like maybe a rude casting director or like someone who's like tired
or
jaded.
It's just very extreme. Like those are fighting words to an actor.
Yeah.
To say
look up what Connor Ratliff looks like. Actually, I looked him up in my Gmail, and he was a writer on some stuff I worked on back in at Disney. But
oh, that's funny.
He was like... I think he lived in New York, and so he was like a friend of one of the directors.
Oh, mm-hmm. He does.
I'm looking
have
at his eyes.
Look.
He has great eyes.
Yeah.
They're blue.
It's pretty funny that, you know, maybe the nicest man in Hollywood, you know, like the America's dad said something mean and then
really
fired somebody as like, you know, like a 20-year-old kid or whatever. So
I think the best thing for that podcast is if Tom Hanks became president.
Well, they're really they're into season two, so I'm not fully caught up yet, but they are really gunning to get him on the show, and I think they will
that would
eventually.
Be really epic.
I think nice. it's popular enough now that certainly someone has told him, Tom Hanks, like, hey, there's a podcast about you. Like, it's gotten back to him. There must be. Anyway.
Have we talked about Tom Hanks's Twitter page?
No.
Do you know about it?
No.
He just posts, it's like called Hank, I think it's H-A-N-X or something, at Hanks. And he just posts like lost items he finds, like suck on 5th and, you know, Madison or whatever. I mean, it's just, it's a very weird Twitter
page. I did not know that. I'm actually off Twitter. Ooh. Off Facebook.
Congratulations.
As of Saturday or
free.
Like forever?
As of earlier this year, just with the pandemic, I was on there. There was like a lot of toxic shit going on. And I was like, I'm good. I am still on Instagram.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to be negative
somehow. Yeah. Like it feels more like kind and chill.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really hard
to
complain
mellow.
On Instagram.
Yeah.
Well, Natasha, can you tell us what your unpaid endorsement is?
Yes, my unpaid endorsement is there are some, there's two very exciting runoff elections happening in Georgia early next year, January 5th. And we have the opportunity to have more Democrats in the Senate, and this is a huge opportunity. So there's a great organization called Vote Save America that you can go to, votesaveamerica.com/getmitch, as in Mitch McConnell, to try and take back their majority. So I encourage everybody who gives a shit to check it out and contribute. There's opportunities. You can volunteer, you can phone bank, you can text bank, you can give money. Just every little bit definitely counts. And so we had a huge victory, and now let's keep it going.
If I moved to Georgia right now, do you think I can vote there?
Yeah, you can vote. You can register until December 7th.
But how long do I have to live in Georgia in order to
be a
legal voter?
I bet the information is available to you on votesofamerica.com.
Yeah. Now, you can't just be like, well, we all rented an apartment. All 200 of my friends.
I wonder.
Yeah, I wonder, there must be rules about that.
Look, it's worth a try.
Yeah, listen.
And I've heard this thing about the recent election that the presidential votes were all fraudulent,
such
but
a
the
good point.
Congressional yeah. ones were real. Is that true?
Yeah. Is that real? Yeah. Is that really happening? Yeah.
Yeah, it makes complete logical sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
Oren, what you
awesome.
Got?
So I have, just a thought I had that I'm just going to talk about, which is pretty obvious. But you know when you go buy a car? If we went to buy a car right now, brand new car, what year car would you get?
I don't know. I'm not a big car guy. I would rather buy a recently used car.
Okay.
I don't know if I'll ever buy a real
it's not
car,
supposed to
frankly.
Be a trick question. Basically, if
it's
you went to a dealership now and you're like, hey, I want to get a new
Would you get a 2021?
Yeah.
It'd be next year. Right. Okay.
Right. Even though it's 2020, basically like halfway through the year, they're already putting next year's year on it.
That
and
is
it occurred
stressful.
To me that everybody that listens to this podcast, when you are making your reel, just put next year's year on it. Okay.
That's
I mean,
a
I
good
guess
punchline, Oren.
The
didn't
first
see it coming.
Recommendation is don't put the year on it, but we know you're going to. I don't know why. I don't know why I did it. I don't know why every manager has to call me and say, like, hey, can you take the 2015 off your reel before I send it out? By the time you get the momentum of people watching your reel, it's going to be next year, especially this year. So if you're cutting a reel right now because it's COVID and things are picking up and you want to show people your stuff, just put 2021 on it. It'll make your year last an entire your reel last an entire year longer.
Natasha, as a founder of a production company and a successful commercial director, do you think that putting a year on your reel is worth it in the first place? Is that necessary?
No. I stopped putting the years on a while back, actually, because of exactly what Oren is talking
about. Oh, there you
go.
So, important follow-up question.
So many times it had been like, oh, God, I got it.
I do not currently have a reel. I don't have, like, a sizzly montage reel. I only send just whatever spots are specific.
Yeah,
Where do you land on that?
I took mine down earlier this year, actually, just because it didn't feel like something I was using, and I didn't want it. I didn't want it out there in the world if it wasn't something I was actively using. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Oren's is very, very good, so that's part of it.
Listen, if you have a dope reel, that's awesome. I just never really if it was super cool, I would use it, and then I would keep it. If that makes sense. But it's just at this point, it's more productive for me to just share. And then on the feature side, on the sort of scripted side, very few people look at reels. They'll look at your IMDb or whatever.
Or a trailer to your movie.
Trailer to the movie, yeah.
I noticed your production company has a 91-second reel. And my only note on that is, can we get it to 90 seconds? I think that would be a nice even number.
I'll pass that along.
Well, Natasha, this has been great. How can listeners learn more about your film, Lucky, and also about yourself? Where can they keep track of what's going on?
Yeah, for sure. So unlike me, my production company does have a Twitter. And you can stay up to date. It's at Illium Pictures. So it's Illium Pictures. And people can also follow Shudder. We're releasing with Shudder, which is a horror streaming service. We're super happy. And
first 7 days for free. Sorry.
7 days for free. Yeah, exactly. So if you time it out right, you can catch us in that.
And it's
7 days.
Shudder with a D, right?
Yes, Shudder. Like, ooh, scary.
Like udder.
Yeah.
Except not like
no, udder. Not like udder.
Like the other udder.
No, yeah.
Like an utter shame.
Oh.
No.
Udder. No.
Udder. Like
no,
the
no.
cow udders?
Like
a cow's teat, yeah. I think.
Yes. Yes.
Not like, utter despair.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Utter despair.
Yeah.
That's when you're milking the wrong. Yeah.
Keep going.
That's all I got.
So yeah, so Ilium Pictures or Shudder will have all the info. And if you want to see my Phantom Thread memes, I'm at Nata Kerm on Instagram.
Oh, cool. And Ilium is having a creative retreat sometime soon, right?
Is that... Everyone's invited.
Yeah, it's only $1,000 a piece.
It's in Albany.
I'm happy to invite you, Oren, to our creative retreat.
Oh, thank you.
I can tell that you're like a really positive person. Mm-hmm. And you're really like, you're going to strive to get to that.
Yeah, Oren's just got some blockage. You know, I feel I sense some resistance. But as soon as you unlock that, I think all of your dreams will come true.
Yeah, worked for John Travolta. What can it do for me?
Yeah.
Well, if you guys want to learn more about what we talked about, you can go to our website, justshootitpodcast.com. We will post everything we talked about in the show notes. You can email us any questions, comments. If you want to ask Natasha anything, we'll forward it on to her. Our email address is justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can follow me on Instagram. I'm at okaplan, or on Twitter, I'm at smiteypileg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media. The music you're listening to is by the Free Music Archive and the Artist Jazar. This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams, and our social media maestro is Derek Aiello. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.